what is the best way to sequence these drugs, whether, you know, sequencing these drugs is even in some cases feasible if they have the same payload, right? Would you want to use one after the other? And eventually, you know, we will have that data as well, right, of using disitamab vedotin after enfortumab, for instance, or enfortumab after DV, on the other hand. And then, of course, because, again, the drugs often hit different targets and with different chemotherapy payloads, you know, natural question that comes up is also combining these different antibody-drug conjugates, right? And so we've already seen some interesting data of combining, for instance, enfortumab vedotin and sacituzumab govitecan, and that was the DAD study that actually Brad McGregor led at Dana-Farber, and Guru Sampavdeh also worked on when he was there. That was a combination of enfortumab vedotin and sacituzumab govitecan, drugs with very different toxicity profiles. So that's why it's feasible to combine them. But even with that, you know, they had to dose reduce a lot of patients on that study. You really have to be careful as to how do you apply and use that combination. But the efficacy outcomes they saw were pretty impressive. So over 70% response rates, including durable responses, right? And so now we see ongoing trials actually right now that are combining enfortumab vedotin with other TROP2 targeting antibody drug conjugates. There's a drug from Merck, cestuzumab tiramatecan. So, you know, similar in many ways to SG, cestuzumab govitecan, you know, same target and antibody, different payload, right? Still a topoisomerase 1 payload, but a different drug. And so that drug is in trials right now, combining with enfortumab. And, you know, we'll see kind of how tolerable such a combination is, again, what the toxicity profile is, and of course, how effective it is, right? But presumably, we will see at least additive benefit from combining these drugs that are, you know, pretty effective on their own, and in combination, probably even more so. There are a lot of possibilities going forward in a rapidly kind of shifting, you know, treatment landscape as to how we apply these principles to treatment and to these different drugs.
Yeah, outstanding points. And, you know, I think one of the things is, you know, a lot of people focus on in terms of the headlines. And because I know you mentioned the sacituzumab govitecan, TROPiCS-04. Unfortunately, it got removed by the FDA with the accelerated approval, but they removed it because it didn't show the overall survival. But if you look at the data and really dig in, like if you look at the overall survival curve and you look at the number of patients that did not do well in the first 3 months, and then a number of patients that did not receive G-CSF, it does make you wonder. I mean, I still have patients that are still doing well on sacituzumab govitecan. Now, would I start anybody on this medicine right now? No. But if they're still tolerating and they're doing a really good response, I would continue. So I don't know what your experience has been with Vedine, but I know we have the TROPiCS-04 where the company removed the indication, but it just seems like it's still a very effective medicine. It was like a perfect storm on what happened in the first 3 to 6 months with the non-GCSF. What are your thoughts on that?
So sacituzumab govitecan initially was approved, had accelerated approval in advanced urothelial cancer back in 2021, right? And we were using it for several years. But then there was this phase 3 study that compared sacituzumab monotherapy to essentially a taxane. And there was, potentially, at least numerically, a higher response rate with sacituzumab. So it was like 23% versus, a response rate in the teens for taxane-based regimen, but there was no overall survival benefit, right? And there was a lot of commentary as to why that might be. One of the issues was that there was a lot of toxicity and even toxic deaths in the sacituzumab arm from neutropenia and like febrile neutropenia and neutropenic sepsis. And the study did not mandate G-CSF, and maybe had it done that, you know, things would have looked differently. But my experience with sacituzumab, and again, we were using it for several years, I think in many ways kind of mirrors yours. I've had, you know, patients who are exceptional responders on it, I think, who are alive today because, you know, they got the drug a couple of years ago, right? And who are on it actually for an extended period of time and clearly benefited from it. Now, many patients did require dose reductions. Many patients also, I think, you know, required G-CSF. And so, you know, towards the end, I think all the patients I was starting on sacituzumab, I was using G-CSF even from the get-go for primary prophylaxis. And I think that probably what should have been done in the trial. Now, so yeah, I mean, I still think I do think it's an effective drug. It's still approved, you know, in breast cancer. And I think there is a role for it in urothelial cancer. But FDA label has been actually voluntarily withdrawn by the company. I don't know to what extent it will be, you know, used anymore. But at the same time, you know, if you have a patient who's reached the sort of that fourth, fifth line situation, right, and had progressed on prior available regimens, and now you're usually a patient like that after prior platinum, prior EV, has some neuropathy, and you're choosing between, you know, a taxane and sacituzumab, with significant neuropathy, you probably won't really give them taxanes, right? And in that situation, you could still potentially consider sacituzumab if, you know, while, of course, you know, discussing with the patient the potential risks of it, and I think taking steps to kind of mitigate those risks. Because, again, I mean, one thing I will say is that we don't really have a lot of data, certainly not prospective data, of sacituzumab use after enfortumab, right? But in the standard of care setting, that's really generally the setting in which we were using it, right? So more like fourth line therapy after prior platinum immunotherapy in enfortumab. And so we have some data from the retrospective UNITE study, which we presented in abstract form and hopefully we'll publish as well, looking at sacituzumab outcomes after enfortumab. And again, I think there is certainly a subset of patients that benefit. And so I hope they're will be an ongoing role for this drug, but it's challenging to say, I think, at this point, what that role would be.
Yeah, great points. And you know, I know at our last ASCO with Andreas Necki presenting the neoadjuvant as sacituzumab govitecan with GCSF support. I know you mentioned the DADIO maybe study, and also I hope that the studies continue. And you know, the deruxtecan piece, which is the payload, seems to have activity because at the ASCO GU, you had data DXT. And so it's kind of like we were talking about the Lego pieces again. Like have the deruxtecan, you have the vedotin, and then the payload is different from like the antibody, but you have all these mixing and matching. And so it's going to be interesting. But, you know, Vadim, as a leader in the field, one of the things I want to kind of ask you is for the general oncologist here in the OncLive audience is, you know, you have that EV Pembro, and, you know, a majority of our patients are going to get EV Pembro. Then you start thinking, okay, they progress, even though the update at ASCO GU looks great. You know, a majority of those patients end up progressing. Then you start thinking platinum doublet, maybe FGFR3 alterations. And then maybe, you know, because I know you did some studies with immunotherapy. Like, what do you typically do? Where's the research there? Is there any research about re-challenging immunotherapy? Or what do you think about post-EV Pembro that are FGFR3, they don't have any alterations?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. And I will also, again, say that even though right now we're using EVP a lot in the metastatic setting, you know, a few years down the line, we may actually be using it even earlier, right? So in the perioperative space, especially if those trials of perioperative EV Pembro, you know, before surgery and following radical cystectomy with just Pembro, and also some EV component, if those read out as positive, right? So then your question will become even more pertinent in the metastatic setting, right? If you have many patients who, when they had muscle invasive disease, were treated with EV Pembro, now if they unfortunately, you know, do have metastatic disease developed later, what do you give them, right? Usually patients who are unexposed to platinum, we will use platinum doublets, and that makes sense, right? But is there a role for rechallenge with immunotherapy, in particular for patients who had done well on an immunotherapy regimen previously, right? And I think at least now we do have some data to highlight in this disease specifically in advanced urothelial cancer. So this was actually a post-hoc analysis that we recently published in European Urology of post-hoc analysis of data from several of the KEYNOTE studies, okay? So KEYNOTE 45, KEYNOTE 52, and KEYNOTE 361. These were all trials of pembrolizumab alone or in combination with chemotherapy in the front line or in the treatment refractory setting, right? And so these were several hundred patients then who received pembrolizumab, and many of them actually had really good and durable responses, right? So this post-hoc analysis included patients who either completed the predetermined 2 years of treatment after having at least stable disease as best response, or patients who had a complete response, completed at least around 8 cycles of therapy and then paused treatment. So per protocol in these KEYNOTE studies, these patients, after stopping treatment, after having, you know, really good response or clinical benefit, they were on surveillance. But then if they had radiographic progression while on surveillance, they could be re-challenged with pembrolizumab again. And so this post-hoc analysis looked specifically at what were the outcomes for these patients that were re-challenged. And there were 49 such patients that met these criteria and were re-challenged with pembrolizumab. The median treatment-free interval from, you know, the time that they stopped prior treatment to, you know, restarting pembrolizumab challenge was about 11 months. And actually, among, you know, those almost 50 patients, 49 patients, we saw a pretty robust response rates of 41%, 82% disease control rate. So most patients, actually, over 80%, you would argue, benefited from rechallenge. Those who responded had usually pretty prolonged responses. Median duration of response was over a year. It was 14 months. Median PFS and OS were 9 months and 26 months, respectively, from the time of rechallenge. So rechallenging patients with immunotherapy, or at least an immunotherapy-based regimen, probably is a viable approach, but probably for selected patients. And these are patients who probably had a reasonable, at least a reasonable response to immunotherapy before, and also patients who are probably off immunotherapy for at least some time. So that's, those are the patients probably we should be selecting for potential rechallenge with immune-based regimens. There's much more that I think we really have to look at and study in this space, right? In renal cell carcinoma, of course, and that's an example everyone will cite, there have been two large studies of rechallenge with a, you know, immunotherapy-based regimen that were negative, right? We haven't had those studies yet for all comers in urothelial cancer, and arguably we probably shouldn't. But there are probably subsets of patients that we can successfully rechallenge with, again, an immunotherapy-based regimen. And I think future trials should focus on that and figuring out who those subsets are. And I will finally just highlight, we also had a poster just at the recent GU ASCO looking at EV and pembrolizumab treatment. This is a retrospective analysis also from the UNITE study, looking at EV pembrolizumab treatment in patients who had had prior immunotherapy. Because, of course, in a trial like EV-302 with got EV pembro approved, all patients were immunotherapy naive. But when we look at patients treated in a real-world setting with EV pembro after having had prior exposure to immunotherapy, whether in a metastatic setting or adjuvant setting, we do still see fairly robust response rates. So about 49% observed response rate with EV pembro. And again, about an 80% disease control rate. So somewhat lower numbers, of course, than we saw in EV-302. But numbers that I think suggest you can give EV pembro after prior immunotherapy, so even in those exposed patients. But again, this is retrospective data. I think this is, again, I think something future trials will focus on prospectively as well.